Chapter 25. While we were hanging about near the water's edge, as sailors idling ashore will do, it was in the open space before the harbor office of a Great Eastern port. A man came towards us from the front of business houses, aiming obliquely at the landing steps. He attracted my attention, because in the movement of figures in white drill suits on the pavement from which he stepped, his costume, the usual tunic and trousers, being made of light gray flannel, made him noticeable. I had time to observe him. He was stout, but he was not grotesque. His face was round and smooth, his complexion very fair. On his near approach I saw a little mustache made all the fairer by a good many white hairs. And he had, for a stout man, quite a good chin. In passing us, he exchanged nods with the friend I was with and smiled. My friend was Hollis, the fellow who had so many adventures, and had known so many queer people in that part of the more or less gorgeous East in the days of his youth. He said, "Hat's a good man. I don't mean good in the sense of smart or skillful in his trade. I mean a really good man." I turned round at once to look at the phenomenon. The really good man had a very broad back. I saw him signal a sampan to come alongside, get into it, and go off in the direction of a cluster of local steamers anchored close inshore. I said, "He's a seaman, isn't he?" "Yes. Commands that biggish dark green steamer, Sissy Glasgow. ." He has never commanded anything else, but the Sissy Glasgow, only it wasn't always the same Sissy. The first he had was about half the length of this one, and we used to tell poor Davidson that she was a size too small for him. Even at that time Davidson had bulk. We warned him he would get callosities on his shoulders and elbows because of the tight fit of his command. And Davidson could well afford the smiles he gave us for our chaff. He made lots of money in her. She belonged to a portly Chinaman resembling a mandarin in a picture book, with goggles and thin drooping mustaches, and as dignified as only a celestial knows how to be. The best of Chinamen as employers is that they have such gentlemanly instincts. Once they become convinced that you are a straight man, they give you their unbounded confidence. You simply can't do wrong then. And they are pretty quick judges of character too. Davidson's Chinaman was the first to find out his worth on some theoretical principle. One day in his counting house, before several white men, he was heard to declare, "Captain Davidson is a good man." And that settled it. After that, you couldn't tell if it was Davidson who belonged to the Chinaman or the Chinaman who belonged to Davidson. It was he who, shortly before he died, ordered in Glasgow the new Sissy for Davidson to command. We walked into the shade of the harbor office, and leaned our elbows on the parapet of the quay. "She was really meant to comfort poor Davidson," continued Hollis. "Can you fancy anything more naively touching than this old mandarin spending several thousand pounds to console his white man? Well, there she is. The old mandarin's sons have inherited her, and Davidson with her, and he commands her, and what with his salary and trading privileges he makes a lot of money, and everything is as before, and Davidson even smiles. You have seen it? Well, the smile's the only thing which isn't as before." "Tell me, Hollis," I asked, "what do you mean by good in this connection?" "Well, there are men who are born good just as others are born witty. What I mean is his nature. No simpler, more scrupulously delicate soul had ever lived in such a comfortable envelope. How we used to laugh at Davidson's fine scruples. In short, he's thoroughly humane, and I don't imagine there can be much of any other sort of goodness that counts on this earth. And as he's that with a shade of particular refinement, I may well call him a really good man." I knew from old that Hollis was a firm believer in the final value of shades. And I said, "See," because I really did see Hollis's Davidson in the sympathetic stout man who had passed us a little while before. But I remembered that at the very moment he smiled, his placid face appeared veiled in melancholy, a sort of spiritual shadow. I went on. Who on earth has paid him off for being so fine by spoiling his smile? That's quite a story, and I will tell it to you if you like. Confound it. It's quite a surprising one, too. Surprising in every way, but mostly in the way it knocked over poor Davidson, and apparently, only because he is such a good sort. He was telling me all about it only a few days ago. He said that when he saw these four fellows with their heads in a bunch over the table, he at once didn't like it. He didn't like it at all. You mustn't suppose that Davidson is a soft fool. These men, but I had better begin at the beginning. We must go back to the first time the old dollars had been called in by our government in exchange for a new issue. Just about the time when I left these parts to go home for a long stay. Every trader in the islands was thinking of getting his old dollars sent up here in time, and the demand for empty French wine cases, you know, the dozen of vermouth or claret size, was something unprecedented. The custom was to pack the dollars in little bags of 100 each. I don't know how many bags each case would hold. A good lot. Pretty tidy sums must have been moving afloat just then. But let us get away from here. Won't do to stay in the sun. Where could we? I know. Let us go to those tiffin rooms over there. We moved over accordingly. Our appearance in the long empty room at that early hour caused visible consternation amongst the China boys. But Hollis led the way to one of the tables between the windows screened by rattan blinds. A brilliant half-light trembled on the ceiling, on the whitewashed walls, bathed the multitude of vacant chairs and tables in a peculiar stealthy glow. All right. We will get something to eat when it's ready, he said, waving the anxious Chinaman waiter aside. He took his temples touched with gray between his hands, leaning over the table to bring his face, his dark, keen eyes, closer to mine. Davidson then was commanding the steamer Sissy, the little one which we used to chaff him about. He ran her alone, with only the Malay Serang for a deck officer. The nearest approach to another white man on board of her was the engineer, a Portuguese half-caste, as thin as a lath and quite a youngster at that. For all practical purposes, Davidson was managing that command of his single-handed, and of course this was known in the port. I am telling you of it because the fact had its influence on the developments you shall hear of presently. His steamer, being so small, could go up tiny creeks and into shallow bays, and through reefs, and over sandbanks, collecting produce, where no other vessel but a native craft would think of venturing. It is a paying game, often. Davidson was known to visit in her places that no one else could find, and that hardly anybody had ever heard of. The old dollars being called in, Davidson's Chinaman thought that the Sissy would be just the thing to collect them from small traders in the less frequented parts of the archipelago. It's a good business. Such cases of dollars are dumped aft in the ship's lazarette, and you get good freight for very little trouble and space. Davidson, too, thought it was a good idea, and together they made up a list of his calls on his next trip. Then Davidson, he had naturally the chart of his voyages in his head, remarked that on his way back he might look in at a certain settlement up a mere creek, where a poor sort of white man lived in a native village. Davidson pointed out to his Chinaman that the fellow was certain to have some rattans to ship. Probably enough to fill her forward, apostrophe said Davidson. And that'll be better than bringing her back with empty holds. A day more or less doesn't matter. Apostrophe, apostrophe, this was sound talk, and the Chinaman owner could not but agree. But if it hadn't been sound, it would have been just the same. Davidson did what he liked. He was a man that could do no wrong. However, this suggestion of his was not merely a business matter. There was in it a touch of Davidsonian kindness. For you must know that the man could not have continued to live quietly up that creek if it had not been for Davidson's willingness to call there from time to time. And Davidson's Chinaman knew this perfectly well too. So he only smiled his dignified bland smile, and said, "All right, Captain. You do what you like." Apostrophe, I will explain presently how this connection between Davidson and that fellow came about. Now I want to tell you about the part of this affair which happened here, the preliminaries of it. You know as well as I do that these tiffin rooms, where we are sitting now, have been in existence for many years. Well, next day about 12 o'clock, Davidson dropped in here to get something to eat. And here comes the only moment in this story where accident, mere accident, plays a part. If Davidson had gone home that day for tiffin, there would be now, after 12 years or more, nothing changed in his kindly, placid smile. But he came in here, and perhaps it was sitting at this very table that he remarked to a friend of mine that his next trip was to be a dollar collecting trip. He added, laughing, that his wife was making rather a fuss about it, as he had begged him to stay ashore and get somebody else to take his place for a voyage. She thought there was some danger on account of the dollars. He told her, he said, that there were no Java Sea pirates nowadays except in boys' books. He had laughed at her fears, but he was very sorry too, for when she took any notion in her head it was impossible to argue her out of it. She would be worrying herself all the time he was away. Well, he couldn't help it. There was no one ashore fit to take his place for the trip. This friend of mine and I went home together in the same mail boat, and he mentioned that conversation one evening in the Red Sea, while we were talking over the things and people we had just left, with more or less regret. I can't say that Davidson occupied a very prominent place. Moral excellence seldom does. He was quietly appreciated by those who knew him well. But his more obvious distinction consisted in this, that he was married. Ours, as you remember, was a bachelor crowd, in spirit anyhow, if not absolutely in fact. There might have been a few wives in existence, but if so they were invisible, distant, never alluded to. For what would have been the good? Davidson alone was visibly married. Being married suited him exactly. It fitted him so well that the wildest of us did not resent the fact when it was disclosed. Directly he had felt his feet out here, Davidson sent for his wife. She came out from West Australia in the Somerset, under the care of Captain Ritchie, you know, Monkey Face Ritchie, who couldn't praise enough her sweetness, her gentleness, and her charm. She seemed to be the heaven-born mate for Davidson. She found on arrival a very pretty bungalow on the hill, ready for her, and the little girl they had. Very soon he got for her a two-wheeled trap and a Burma pony, and she used to drive down of an evening to pick up Davidson, on the quay. When Davidson, beaming, got into the trap, it would become very full all at once. We used to admire Mrs. Davidson from a distance. It was a girlish head out of a keepsake. From a distance. We had not many opportunities for a closer view, because she did not care to give them to us. We would have been glad to drop in at the Davidson bungalow, but we were made to feel somehow that we were not very welcome there. Not that she ever said anything ungracious. She never had much to say for herself. I was perhaps the one who saw most of the Davidsons at home. What I noticed under the superficial aspect of vapid sweetness was her convex, obstinate forehead, and her small, red, pretty, ungenerous mouth. But then I am an observer with strong prejudices. Most of us were fetched by her white, swan-like neck, by that drooping, innocent profile. There was a lot of latent devotion to Davidson's wife hereabouts, at that time, I can tell you. But my idea was that she repaid it by a profound suspicion of the sort of men we were, a mistrust which extended, I fancied, to her very husband at times. And I thought then she was jealous of him in a way, though there were no women that she could be jealous about, as he had no women's society. It's difficult for a shipmaster's wife, unless there are other shipmaster's wives about, and there were none here then. I know that the dock manager's wife called on her, but that was all. The fellows here formed the opinion that Mrs. Davidson was a meek, shy little thing. She looked it, I must say. And this opinion was so universal that the friend I have been telling you of remembered his conversation with Davidson simply because of the statement about Davidson's wife. He even wondered to me, fancy Mrs. Davidson making a fuss to that extent. She didn't seem to me the sort of woman that would know how to make a fuss about anything. ... I wondered, too, but not so much. That bumpy forehead, eh? I had always suspected her of being silly. And I observed that Davidson must have been vexed by this display of wifely anxiety. My friend said, no. He seemed rather touched and distressed. There really was no one he could ask to relieve him, mainly because he intended to make a call in some godforsaken creek, to look up a fellow of the name of Bamps who apparently had settled there. ... And again my friend wondered. Tell me, he cried, what connection can there be between Davidson and such a creature as Bamps? I don't remember now what answer I made. A sufficient one could have been given in two words. Davidson's goodness. That never boggled at unworthiness, if there was the slightest reason for compassion. I don't want you to think that Davidson had no discrimination at all. Bamps could not have imposed on him. Moreover, everybody knew what Bamps was. He was a loafer with a beard. When I think of Bamps, the first thing I see is that long black beard and a lot of propitiatory wrinkles at the corners of two little eyes. There was no such beard from here to Polynesia, where a beard is a valuable property in itself. Bamps's beard was valuable to him in another way. You know how impressed Orientals are by a fine beard. Years and years ago, I remember, the grave Abdullah, the great trader of Sambir, unable to repress signs of astonishment and admiration at the first sight of that imposing beard. And it's very well known that Bamps lived on Abdullah off and on for several years. It was a unique beard, and so was the bearer of the same. A unique loafer. He made a fine art of it, or rather a sort of craft and mystery. One can understand a fellow living by cadging and small swindles in towns, in large communities of people, but Bamps managed to do that trick in the wilderness, to loaf on the outskirts of the virgin forest. He understood how to ingratiate himself with the natives. He would arrive in some settlement up a river, make a present of a cheap carbon, or a pair of shoddy binoculars, or something of that sort, to the Raja, or the head man, or the principal trader, and on the strength of that gift, ask for a house, posing mysteriously as a very special trader. He would spin them no end of yarns, live on the fat of the land, for a while, and then do some mean swindle, or other, or else they would get tired of him, and ask him to quit. And he would go off meekly with an air of injured innocence. Funny life. Yet, he never got hurt somehow. I've heard of the Raja of Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.